From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. You might make plans for next week or next year, but are you looking ahead 30 years in the future? We'll chat with an NC State economist who's making projections about North Carolina in the year 2050. In the age of Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, North Carolina is taking new steps to prevent insiders from threatening state government data. You'll learn details. There's no easy recipe for advancing public policy goals, but you'll learn some basic guidelines from the chairman of the John Locke Foundation, and we'll examine some of the most significant facts and figures linked to North Carolina's public schools. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
It is no secret that relations have been a bit testy between Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's administration and the Republican-led General Assembly. But as Carolina Journal Associate Editor Dan Way has been reporting, the controversy surrounding the $57.8 million discretionary fund that is attached to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline deal has made things a bit worse. Dan is here to tell us what some political analysts have been telling him, which he's been reporting, of course, at CarolinaJournal.com. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
So the Cooper administration seemed to be a bit caught off guard by the reaction to a couple of things recently. Number one, the administration's approval of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline into North Carolina. And then also the reaction to this discretionary fund that was apparently negotiated separately but attached to the pipeline deal. What'd you make of this? You've been covering this whole story.
Well, the surprise is that the administration was surprised about the reaction, because what they did was outside the bounds of normal legislative process. The state constitution gives the General Assembly the power of the purse, basically. So budget issues and appropriations are supposed to go through the General Assembly. What the governor attempted to do here was to circumvent that process. So obviously you would have a tension there between the two branches.
The approval of the pipeline itself also got some pushback from some folks who would generally be considered to be in the governor's camp, some of the environmentalist folks who didn't want that deal to go through. So it seemed to me that he kind of had pushback on from both angles, people that would traditionally support him and then other people who said, hey, wait a second, you're sort of cutting us out of this deal.
Right, and it's no secret. There are opponents to the pipeline, and there will be continued protest as this continues, the process continues. So what many people think is the governor tried to play both sides, approving the pipeline where he could say, hey, we're creating jobs, we're creating opportunities. And also with this separate deal that he orchestrated, be able to do some business development, he called it, jobs, as well as renewable energy projects, so that he may have attempted to give the folks on the left a little bit of fodder, saying, oh, okay, well, he wants to do some solar work in the eastern part of the state as well.
It's been very interesting, I think, to watch the reaction in the media coverage. And in some cases, it's been predictable. People who generally support the governor will defend him. People who generally oppose his policies will say he shouldn't have done this. But, Dan, what I love about your latest reporting on this at CarolinaJournal.com is that you went to several political analysts who really aren't looking at this from a Democratic perspective or a Republican perspective. They're on the outside looking in and assessing how the governor in general is conducting his business, and they told you some fascinating things.
Right. So that was the nature of my reporting. I wanted to go beyond the politics of it and look more at it as a policy issue, and whether or not the governor was on solid footing with the way he handled the matter. And what I was told by some of these political observers was that they felt he missed a golden opportunity to be able to bring the two sides together. There was enough credit there for everyone to share. Had he gone through the normal process, involved the legislature, they still could have done, you know, the press releases and the public appearances saying, hey, look what we've done. You know, there's a wide bridge between the executive and the legislative branch right now.
A lot of lawsuits,
you know, a lot of lawsuits
on that bridge.
You know, there's the vetoes and the veto override. So it's been a very rocky relationship since he's been inaugurated. And this was, as the political analysts say, probably the governor shooting himself in the foot.
It is rather curious, to your point about trying to reach out and perhaps find an issue upon which he could get some Republican support. You're talking about lower cost energy coming into the state through the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about some job creation, some economic development in the eastern part of the state. It is really a head scratcher as to why perhaps some of his advisors didn't say to him, look, here's something where you can actually be seen as reaching out to the other side, which in many cases North Carolinians say they want to see.
Right, and that's where some of the political analysts question the inner circle that Cooper has surrounded himself with, whether they're giving him good advice, that he probably should have seen this as the landmine that it ended up he stepped on. Somehow he was blind to the fallout that happened, and that's kind of puzzling why someone who's been in the public realm as long as he has couldn't have foreseen that happening.
And the fallout really has not died down. In fact, in just a few days, it looks like there may be a legislative hearing. You have a state legislator who has now made a request that there be a legislative hearing looking into exactly how this whole deal, the discretionary fund, nearly $58 million, how that whole process came about and why the General Assembly was essentially cut out of this when, as you said, they are the appropriators of the state coffers.
Right. And this was Senator Bill Rabin. He's the Senate Rules Chairman. And this is another piece of the rocky relationship here. So the governor has refused to release the public records involving much of the formation of this $58 million fund. And the Republicans have requested that repeatedly. He's not complied, yet he gave some of this information they were requesting to a television station. So
Now, wait a second. That's an interesting point in and of itself. So the legislature had requested documents about how this all came together, and they couldn't get them?
Right. And
But a television station was able to get them.
Right. We've requested the same records, and we've not gotten them either. So this, you know, it's kind of like rubbing –
that's a salt in the wound type
right.
thing.
So that was what prompted Senator Rabin to seek this legislative oversight hearing. And the Joint Legislative Commission on Energy Policy also had a hearing in which it was determined from questioning of State Department of Environmental Quality officials whether or not their permitting process took care of all the issues for mitigation, environmental disturbance restoration. And the Department of Environmental Quality official said, yeah, everything that needed to be done would have been taken care of through our normal process, that this outside deal that the governor made would have done nothing in terms of repairing any damage to streams, wetlands, buffers. Those were all taken care of through the permitting process. And that, you know, the utility partners are going to put up $6 million. That's the sum total for everything they have to restore to its natural state after they're done constructing the pipeline. The governor asked for 10 times that amount in his separate fund. So
Dan, then what was this $57.8 million separate deal all about if the mitigation funds were already taken care of through the permitting process?
Well, certainly the Republicans think that it was all about the governor being able to dole out some goodies. It's been repeatedly called a slush fund. They've accused the governor of shaking down the utility companies and that he would be able to put this money out there for crony companies to do things or whatever, to score political points. I mean, that's how they're viewing it.
And Dan, before we leave the story this week, give us the summary of where that actually stands right now. The governor originally in this memorandum of understanding had set this up so that he would control, along with the board, he would control those funds. What happened?
Well, there's been a bill passed by the General Assembly to take control of that money, give it to the eight counties through which the pipeline passes in North Carolina for educational purposes. the money has not been received. Whether the companies will give the money now to the state is up in the air.
Dan Way is associate editor of Carolina Journal. Dan, thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many of us think about what's going to happen next week, next month, maybe even next year, but what about in 10, 20, or even 30 years down the road? Our next guest has been thinking about these issues and writing about them. Dr. Michael Walden is an economist at North Carolina State University, and he is also author of the new book, North Carolina Beyond the Connected Age, the Tar Heel State in 2050. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Mitch.
Why did you decide it was a good idea to look ahead to 2050 and project where the state would be?
Well, I've got a serious answer and a non-serious answer to that. 2050, I thought, was a kind of a flashy year. I mean, it's mid-century. It's far enough away that people can think, oh, yeah, that's the future. But it's not that far away that we can conceive of maybe taking some action today that might influence where we are. That's a serious answer. The non-serious answer is if I'm around in 2050, I'll be 99. So if none of my predictions come true and people say, boy, it's Walden, boy, you did a horrible job, I won't care.
You'll just be happy to have seen it by that point. So the book takes a look at North Carolina in terms of population, mm-hmm. jobs, economy, those sorts of things?
Mm-hmm. It does. It's actually a sequel to the book I wrote about 10 years ago called North Carolina in the Connected Age, which documented the change that we had seen in the 20th century when we were tobacco, textiles, furniture state to what we are now and the impacts on people and jobs and industries and geographical areas. This says, all right, here we are now. We've got the economy we have now. What's going to happen in the future? So, yeah, looking at how those major aspects that affect people's lives, jobs, industries, where people live. I talk some about natural resources. I do think we're going to grow. I think we're at about 3 million more people between now and 2050. So, for example, need more water, need more electricity. So I talk about some of those issues as well as government policies, tax systems that we might want to think about to adapt to this new economy.
All right. So we're going to see growth. We're going to have those needs. What are some of the other things that you put out there on the table that we need to be considering?
Well, I think probably the biggest issue I talk about is one that's gotten a lot of press nationally because it's the same issue in the nation as North Carolina, is jobs. What kind of changes are we going to have in jobs, particularly how will technology affect jobs? There's some very well done and very well respected economic studies that have been done. In fact, MIT released one, I think, 2 weeks ago that said half of today's occupations, half, won't be around by mid-century. There are other studies that say, well, that's overdone. But I think clearly we can already see where technology and the fact that technology is getting more adept about doing more things, it's not just technology coming to the assembly line and putting fenders on cars as they go by. It's now artificial intelligence. It's now capability for machines to think faster than humans can think, for example. So there are some who say even so-called white-collar jobs, professional jobs, some of those will go away because technology will do that. So I spend a lot of time talking about that, talking, I run some numbers about, well, what, how could that affect North Carolina's economy? Will we have new jobs? And then particularly I talk about where I think the areas where we might have job growth will occur, because this isn't the first time we've had technological change that affects employment. We've gone through that in the last 100 years at least twice, and we've always seemed to create new jobs. And that's probably what most economists would think, but there are some who think, no, this time is different.
That is the voice of Dr. Michael Walden, professor and economist at North Carolina State University, also author of this new book, North Carolina Beyond the Connected Age, The Tar Heel State in 2050. Now, some people are going to be reading this from the vantage point of, oh, this is interesting to look ahead and see what might be happening. Others will say, okay, this book gives us a sense of what we need to be planning for, what we need to be talking about today, so that we're going to be in the best place possible in 2050. From that vantage point, what sorts of things do you see that we need to be discussing, thinking about now?
And I take and I do address that, and you're going to address it from private sector as well as public sector. I think in terms of private sector, one of the clear trends, and I don't think many people dispute this, is that we're going to be an older society in 2050 than we are today. In the 2010 census, 13% of North Carolinians were 65 and over. In the 2050 census, it's expected it'll be 21%. So that's going to affect everything. It's going to affect every business. So one of the things I tell business audiences I talk to, you got to have a plan to reach that market. I think also if we do have technological change, and clearly that is going to affect some occupations, people need to think about if their occupation is downsized, what am I going to get retrained for? So I think every worker ought to have in their back pocket some alternative that they might want to pursue. On the public sector side, I think what I just said has great implications for our educational system, particularly above high school, because I think we're going to have to be more flexible with our resources, because there'll be some majors that we don't need any longer, some new majors. So universities, colleges are going to have to shift things around. And I also think they will see a different kind of student coming. Normally, most of our students are 18 and 22. I think in the future, we could see a lot of 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds who just are there because their occupation went away. So I think those are some of the major implications I talk about in the book.
You are an economist, and economists have to deal with trade-offs. So if we start devoting more resources to one thing today, that means resources we can't devote to something else later. How important is it for people who are looking ahead that far down the road not to do too much today that would handcuff them in the future?
Well, and we think about this mainly in the public sector, and I do think that in the educational area, we may need to be devoting more resources to K through 12, which means that unless we're going to spend a lot more money in total, we're going to have to look for getting those funds from somewhere else. And I think universities particularly are going to have to get more private sector funding. NC State's a good example of this. We built a whole new campus, Centennial Campus, with a lot of private funds. It's operating with a lot of private funds. I think that's going to be more the model for universities in the future. I also hope that we can use technology to improve the efficiency of government. I think technology is going to have a big effect on our highway system. There are some who say that ride sharing is going to be the mode of the future, and they predict maybe a 90% drop in car ownership, which means we probably won't need as many roads out there. So that could be definitely be a good trend. And then in healthcare, which does affect North Carolina in the sense that we share in the Medicaid funding with the federal government, hopefully technology will start to bring some efficiencies to healthcare that will help us reach more people more effectively.
I also want to loop back to one of the words that you used earlier, and that was flexibility, which is something the government often has trouble with. How important is it that we got to keep this idea of being flexible enough to deal with the changing conditions?
And that is hard to do. I think any bureaucracy resists, whether it's in the private sector or public sector, resists flexibility. Now, in the private sector, you've got the profit motive, you've got a clear line of control, so it's a little easier to move resources around. Not so much in the public sector, and that's one of the things I've been telling my colleagues at the university is we're going to need to start to monitor occupational changes and not be afraid to shift resources around. NC State's actually done some of this in the past decade. It's been subtle, but they've done some of this. So I think that's going to be incredibly important, not just in terms of keeping a moderate level of taxation, where we're not funding things we don't need, but also in terms of responding to these changes, for example, in the workforce, where there will be different occupations that we need to train people for and maybe not as much training in other areas.
You can learn much more about these issues by reading the book. It is titled North Carolina Beyond the Connected Age, the Tar Heel State in 2050. Its author is Dr. Mike Walden, a professor and economist at North Carolina State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. With cases in the headlines involving such infamous characters as Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, North Carolina state government is now looking at threats to its data from government insiders. State Chief Information Risk Officer Marcia Thompson recently offered lawmakers a status report.
We are at our infancy stage within the state of North Carolina of establishing a program for insider threat detection and mitigation. So just so you're aware, we are working on that. Definitely the first thing that we focused on was establishing a governance for this. Insider threat is not just, and this is a key thing, it's not just an IT problem. What IT brings is means and measures in to enable us to detect what those insider threats actions could be. But it is an ecosystem in order to within an organization to build a robust insider threat program and to identify what these actions could be, whether they're malicious or not malicious. Who is an insider? An insider could be anyone. It could be, obviously, the infamous Snowden. We have Chelsea Manning, and we also have, it could be the little old lady that works in our library in our systems. An insider threat could be an intentional action or an unintentional action. And we've seen a huge increase in insider threats globally within companies that we are, frankly, not prepared to react to because we're not necessarily doing the things. And when I say we, not just the state, but as a whole, in order to identify these actions that are occurring on our network. 60% to 70% of attacks are from insiders. And I know, you know, when you hear that, it's an alarming because you're thinking that, well, we're spending a lot of money on protecting exterior people coming in when it's usually a lot of cases it's the people from inside. And remember, this number counts those folks that have inadvertently misconfigured systems that are being hacked. 29% stole information on the way out the door. And this is why it's important that we have processes in place within our organizations to ensure that when we're going to terminate our personnel, that we restrict their access prior to, and we are making sure that we are monitoring what their activities are prior to leaving that organization. 9% were saboteurs. So by and large, the Snowdens of the world, they're smaller footprint, or the folks that are actually negatively impacting your systems by whether they're placing Trojan viruses and so on and so forth out the door is a smaller than someone taking your data and leaving your environment.
Thompson says training and awareness are key tools in helping to battle insider threats against government data. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. People interested in advancing public policy should remember some basic lessons. That's the message from John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood. He outlined the lessons during a recent speech for the Leadership Institute in Washington, D.C.
The first one is dream big, start small. If you don't have a big, audacious vision for change, no one is going to follow you anywhere. I dream that one day in our town where Democrats beat us 4-1, we will be beaten by 3-1. You know, this is not a big audacious dream. On the other hand, if you were to organize, actually, this is literally what happened. My friend Jim Martin, who eventually became the governor of North Carolina, he was a professor of chemistry at Davidson. He had a PhD from Princeton in organic chemistry. Ultimately, by the way, when he was in Congress in the 70s, he was instrumental in saving Sweet and Low, saccharin. He and Teddy Kennedy, by the way, allied to save. Teddy Kennedy was no stranger to sugar, as it turns out. But they did save saccharin. Anyway, when he was a professor at Davidson, he really was tasked with, they were losing the particular town. It was a very liberal college town in North Carolina. They were losing, the Republicans were losing 4-1. And in a subsequent election, they really did just lose 3-1. And that was actually a step towards something good. In other words, the dream is not to lose by 3-1. But if you go from 4-1 to 3-1 to 2-1, you are moving in the right direction. So have a big audacious dream, motivate people, but don't also promise, and by the next election, we will be in charge, or, you know, the Social Security will be privatized, or you know, the flat tax will be passed or something. If you have a goal, a long-term goal that's audacious, great. If you then insist on immediately winning everything you want, you will dispirit your followers. They will lose interest. So there's a calibration here between have a big goal, but be willing to get there in stages. Pretty much everything that is useful has been done in stages. Again, we as conservatives recognize, even when we are trying to change things, there is a certain natural status quo bias that people have. They're comfortable with what they have. You're trying to get them to do something different. We do want to do that. You might have to get there in stages. That's okay.
Hood's first lesson for advancing public policy, dream big, start small.
Second lesson is yearn to learn. You don't know everything. I don't know everything. None of us can know everything. But I guarantee you there's lots of important things that you don't know sitting here today, no matter how old you are and how much experience you have. The politicians that I know that are successful in the long run are always learning. Political activists that I know that are successful in the long run are always learning. They are curious people. They want to know new things. One of the things I can tell about young people, whether they're going to be successful, is do they ask me lots and lots of questions? Now, this annoys me sometimes. But if they don't ask me questions, if they don't express curiosity, it's kind of a warning sign. And with politics in particular, there's always something to learn. The technology of politics is constantly changing. That's not how we did it back in my day. We've all said that. We've all probably meant that. But that's not necessarily a good sign. Yeah, okay. Well, that isn't the way we did it back in the old days. And that's not how we do it now. We have to learn new things constantly.
That's the voice of John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood, speaking recently to the Leadership Institute in Washington, D.C. He's outlining key lessons for advancing public policy.
The third lesson is engage before you wed. Now, this is excellent marital advice, but that's not quite what I mean. What I mean by this, and I'm very serious about this in today's context, you need to figure out how to engage people that you don't agree with. There is no reason why politics and political conversation and public policy debate has to be Armageddon, as Nancy Pelosi said the other day. Just a silly claim. The tax cut might be bad, it might be good. It's not Armageddon, it'll never be Armageddon. But the point is, if you can't imagine why somebody disagrees with you, you will not be successful. I don't know anybody who voted for Donald Trump. I don't know anybody who voted for Hillary Clinton. That's a bad sign, isn't it? Don't you all know people who voted for one or the other? I do. Okay? And the truth is, human beings are rich, complex creatures, and you can learn things from people who have very different political views from you. At the very least, you can learn why they think the way we think. If you're trying to persuade someone, you better be able to make their argument in your head, or you'll never be able to win the argument. And the point I mean by engage before you wed is, don't wed yourself to any particular strategy, any particular goal or bill, until you have a clear sense of why somebody else would be against it. If you can't imagine why anybody would ever be against this bill that has never passed, you will fail. So engage before you wed is good advice, and when politicians do it, when they engage effectively across the aisle, learning from others, not talking about selling out your principles or becoming a mush. I just mean if you know people in the Congress or legislatures and they don't have a good friend from the other side of the aisle, that's also a bad sign. That person is probably unlikely to succeed. If our goal is to succeed and not just to say we're playing the game, one of the ways you succeed is you deeply understand your opponents. One of the best ways to do that is to actually befriend one. It's okay. We're not going to be excommunicated. It's okay. And also, by the way, we ought to be able to have conversations about our political differences and not get into shouting matches and insults. I'm deeply offended by this. I think we as conservatives should be offended by this. We are often the targets of this kind of behavior. And returning fire, it strikes me, is not the right answer here. It's to seek something better than that.
John Hood offered his Washington audience one more basic lesson for advancing public policy.
What's right is rarely wrong. Now, I could mean what's right with a capital R, and that's of course true. Conservatism is rarely wrong. But that's not quite what I mean here. What I mean is when you do things according to your principles, what you believe to be right, in the long run, most of the time, this is in your personal self-interest. This will save you lots and lots of heartache. Human life is a complicated enterprise. We all have tough choices. We often make mistakes. We're fallen creatures. We make mistakes. We yield to temptations. But the truth is that sometimes we make things overly complicated. Well, I know this is the right thing to do, but it will cost me something. It will make me unpopular. It might affect my next election, and therefore I won't do it. This is a mistake. Do what you think is right, and more often than not, over the long run, it will work out for itself.
That's John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood, spelling out four basic lessons for advancing public policy. Dream big, start small, yearn to learn, engage before you wed, what's right is rarely wrong. Hood outlined these lessons during a recent speech to the Leadership Institute in Washington, D.C. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. New data about the state's public school system is now shining a bit of light on things like spending, teacher pay, and incidents of school crime. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies. He's been taking a look at all of this new data, analyzing it for us, and he joins us now with the information. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about spending. Some folks who don't follow the budget as closely as you and I do might be a bit surprised to find out how much money North Carolina taxpayers actually pay to operate the K-12 system. Tell us about that.
Well, total spending across all revenue sources is about $13 billion. And a good portion of that, close to $9 billion, comes from state taxpayers. And then another portion comes from local taxpayers. And really just a small amount, about $1.5 billion, will come from the federal government. So really North Carolina taxpayers are committing a good deal of their tax dollars to public education in North Carolina. And the figures keep going up. That's the other bottom line here, is that there's been no decrease over the years. Now, it may not be keeping up with inflation as much as it should, but the amount that the state spends on our public schools is increasing, not decreasing.
And if my memory serves, I think it takes up about 39% or so of the state's general operating fund. So that is a huge chunk of money. Now, there's always going to be a discussion about, is it enough? Is it too little? Is it too much? Is it about right? Where do you come down on that question in terms of funding?
Well, I want to know how it's spent and whether it's being spent in a productive way. If you look at some of the school districts across North Carolina, what you'll find is school districts that don't spend a whole lot of money but get great results. And then you have school districts that spend a lot of money and don't get very good results at all. And the question is, why does that occur, and what can we do to address the issue of school districts receiving per pupil expenditures that far exceed the state average, and yet the performance of their students is way below the state average. That's what I worry about. How is that money being spent? Is it being spent in a productive way? In other words, what kind of bang for the buck are we getting? That is the question that we need to ask. And often, especially in the media, the question that's asked is, how much are we spending? I want to ask the question is, question of, are we spending the money in a productive and efficient way?
Well, you mentioned the media. That's a perfect transition to another piece of data that you've been writing about at johnlock.org, and that is teacher pay. We're seeing an increase in the average teacher pay. Where do we stand now?
Well, the average teacher pay in North Carolina is now over $51,000. That's about a $1,200 increase from the year prior. And North Carolina's teacher pay has gone up every year for the last four, maybe 5 years. And the reason why is because investments in the teacher pay have been made by the General Assembly. Various increases ranging from about 1% up to 7% on average. So they have made substantial investments in teacher salaries. Now, one thing to remember is this is an average. All teachers, the minimum a teacher can make is $35,000. And this average really speaks to the experience level and the credentials that teachers have, because the way we pay teachers is based on how long they've been in the classroom and which credentials they have. So that is one aspect of this average teacher pay question that we hear so much about. Where does it come from and what does it really mean? On one hand, it is an indicator of how much money we're spending for teacher pay. On the other hand, it's an indicator of the relative experience level of the teacher workforce that we have in North Carolina.
You mentioned that we're paying teachers based on the credentials. Sometimes we call those the inputs for a teacher. Are we making any progress in North Carolina towards trying to recognize and pay really effective teachers based on the outcome, and that would be the achievement of their students?
Yeah, the General Assembly has made this a centerpiece of one of their reform strategies, and that's to identify places where we should be paying high-performing teachers more. Third grade reading teachers, career and technical education teachers, teachers that teach advanced placement courses. These are all teachers that can receive a pay supplement based on funds that the state sets aside for teachers that excel in these areas. Now, this isn't necessarily a way to somehow boost the performance of these high-performing teachers. The idea here is to make sure these teachers stay in the classroom. That's the purpose of any sort of pay boost for teachers, is retention, not necessarily increasing the performance. After all, these are high-performing teachers already.
Interesting that you'd bring that up, because I know you also follow the question of teachers who leave the North Carolina public school system. And you have analyzed that as well and found some interesting information about those types of teachers compared to the people who stay and their effectiveness. What did you find?
Well, this is based on a report that is revised every year by the Department of Public Instruction. And they look at the state of the teacher profession, how many teachers are leaving, how many teachers are moving from one district to another. And lately they've been analyzing, what do the teachers look like that are leaving compared to those who are staying? And what they have found is that the teachers who leave, on average, are less effective than those that stay. That's good turnover. That is the kind of turnover we want in our public schools, because why in the world would we ever want bad teachers or teachers that don't perform on par with their peers to stay in the classroom? They're going to provide an inferior education to our children. So that, to me, is a great news. That's great news that accompanies the turnover report, is that those that are leaving are less capable than those who are staying. And that's one of the things, one of the takeaways from this annual report that the Department of Public Instruction produces.
Terry, there is no doubt that being a teacher is not an easy job. You've been a teacher yourself, and you're now an analyst and a researcher. But it's a tough thing walking into a classroom. And some of the data that you've been looking at that's been coming out of Department of Public Instruction really shines the light on how tough it can be in a classroom. We're talking about crimes and suspensions and expulsions. In other words, kids who are really a challenge for the school system, the teachers, and one would presume their parents as well. What do you find there?
Well, we're seeing a general decrease in reported crimes, and these are crimes that cross all kind of different categories, from very serious to not so serious. But the trend has been a decrease. Some areas, like long-term suspensions, the decrease has been pretty significant, over 30%. In other areas, such as the overall crime rate, we're only seeing about a 4% decrease. So it's trending in the right direction, but really in the scheme of things, it's probably not noticeable to the typical teacher. There will always be student misbehavior. There will always be problems in the classroom. But it's good to know that there is less crime in schools that is being reported by teachers. Now, this is the one knock on this report, is that these are reported crimes. And so it begs the question of, what about the unreported crimes? And we just really can't get a good grasp on that. But the fact that we are seeing a decrease in reported crimes, expulsions, short-term suspensions, long-term suspensions, means that the academic environment that we are creating in our schools is improving rather than deteriorating.
And very quickly, Terry, when you say crimes, what kind of things are you talking about in a classroom?
Well, they could be anything that range from theft to possession of a firearm. And I know the Parkland school shooting has some people concerned about firearms. And what the report found is that there are actually fewer reported instances of students having firearms or explosives. Unfortunately, they put those two together. But there are fewer instances of that than there have been in the past.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And of course, you can read all of Terry's analysis at johnlock.org. Well, that's all the time we have for the show this week. We really appreciate you listening. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.